So if you're hungry and you're crying for a bottle and the person tries to wrap you up and make you warmer because they think that's the problem, then you keep crying that they try something else. And maybe they try the bottle or they try feeding you. And oh, okay, wait, it does work out if I just express what I need. And then when you go out into the world, you have a lot of confidence that people are going to respond to you well. And you act in ways that draw out good responses from others. You're liked better by your teachers and your peers and probably by your work professionals and everybody you come into contact with. And it kind of reinforces your idea that everything usually works out. But rarely are things quite that perfect.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio, a podcast that explores the intersection of leadership, culture, performance, and flow. Through thought-provoking conversations with innovative changemakers and industry leaders, we uncover the mindsets, strategy, and experiences that drive personal and professional excellence. Each episode offers real-world insight, inspiring stories, and actionable wisdom to help you cultivate resilience, purpose, and peak performance in your own life. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we welcome our guest, Dr. Lisa Firestone. Dr. Firestone is a clinical psychologist, the director of research and education at the Glendon Association, a senior editor at psychalive.org, and the co-author of numerous articles and book chapters. Dr. Firestone is a national and international trainer and presenter on topics including couple relations, parenting, suicide, and violence prevention assessment and treatment. I'm honored to tap into the insight and wisdom of Dr. Lisa Firestone on today's episode of Mindful Warrior Radio. Dr. Lisa Firestone, it is a privilege to have you back on Mindful Warrior Radio and to continue our conversation. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Cammie. It's really good to be here with you again.
Oh, wonderful. Today, really, we're wanting to focus our conversation on discovering how we can truly work on ourselves and how we can foster personal growth and development through this greater awareness and understanding of attachment styles. And how do attachment styles come into play in professional relationships with our leadership styles and our decision making? So really, I want to expand this world and bring this knowledge forward for our listeners. And I believe the simplest place to start is truly just defining what are attachment styles.
Yeah. Well, they're the ways that we adapt it. So we get born, right? And we're very helpless at that point. Not a state any of us want to be in, right? Where we can't do anything for ourselves, but that's how we get born. And so, you know, as a baby, your job is to learn those people around you, because you have to figure out how to get your needs met by whoever happens to be there. You don't get to choose your social world. You know, there's whoever happens to be your caretakers. And so you're very tuned in to how they're responding and how they're going to react to you and what you need to do to get whatever it is you need met. So if you have a caretaker who is relatively attuned and paying attention and learning you as a baby and, you know, sensitive to your needs, what happens is that you've learned that it's okay to have a need, first of all. It's good to be in touch with it. It's good to express it, because if you express it, then the person can respond. And the person's likely to respond well. And that reinforces an idea that it's okay to feel what my needs are, to express them, and it's all gonna probably work out. And it's not that it has to be perfect, because there are no perfect parents. What we wanna be is good enough parents. And what that means, you know, what you want is a caretaker who gets it right at least 30% of the time when you're sending out a signal. Because remember, your only signal at that point is crying, which is not a lot of information for the other party. But, you know, you also, when they miss or when something goes awry or doesn't feel good, that there's repair. So if you're hungry and you're crying for a bottle and the person tries to wrap you up and make you warmer because they think that's the problem, then you keep crying, that they try something else. And maybe they try the bottle, or they try feeding you, and oh, okay, wait, it does work out if I just express what I need. And then when you go out into the world, you have a lot of confidence that people are going to respond to you well, and you act in ways that draw out good responses from others. You're liked better by your teachers and your peers, and probably by your work professionals and everybody you come into contact with. And it kind of reinforces your idea that everything usually works out. And that's really, ideal, right? But rarely are things quite that perfect. And so if we, what we learn when we're a baby and we express a need is that nothing happens, and we try again and again and again, and this person is just kind of emotionally tuned out to us, emotionally unavailable. What we learn is that expressing or being in touch with what I need, first of all, is really frustrating because then it leads me to want to express it. And when I do, nothing happens, which makes me feel worthless. We don't think, oh, there's something wrong with my mom, because we lose our sense of safety. We want to feel safe, number one. So, if we want to feel safe, then we've got to think our parent is okay. There must be something I'm doing wrong. And we don't want to feel that shame of nothing happening when we express our need and how unimportant that makes us feel. So we kind of stuff our needs below our level of awareness. And we develop the idea, I'll just take care of myself. I'll act like I don't have any needs. And, that doesn't mean that at age one we can do everything for ourselves. But what we do is we've learned that if we sort of turn down the volume on our needs, keep them under our awareness, and don't act like we have any, our basic needs get met. We get fed, we get shelter, we get enough. But we don't look to our parents to meet those needs. We feel better if they're around, and we know they'll eventually meet our needs, but we don't act like it. We've learned that acting like it would be embarrassing because, we feel shame when nothing happens, right? So that's one adaptation or attachment style called avoidant attachment. We've learned to act like we don't care, we shut it down, we'll just do it on our own. That can be a problem in leadership later on because we try to do everything on our own and we don't like depending on other people because we feel like that's just going to lead to problems. And so we want to do it all ourselves. But the problem is when we keep doing it all ourselves, is the people around us don't grow and they don't help us, and we have limited, capability at some point, right? If we're just doing it all on our own. So if we have that type of adaptation, it's a slow process to learn to trust a bit more. And other people, when they express any needs that we've been able to keep under the surface, seem really needy and really problematic. So we have big reactions when people say, oh, but so you want me to do this? Well, could you give me more information about that? We go, no, you don't need it. Figure it out. What's wrong with you? And that's not helpful for growing people's abilities. When people start off taking on more responsibility, they need a little direction, right? They can't just all do it on their own. So, that's the problem with that style. Another style that might develop is where we have learned to turn up the volume on our needs because we have a parent that are caretakers that are intermittently available. Sometimes they really get it and give us what we need. And sometimes they're acting out of their own need. So they give us a hug because they need a hug. Or when we go to them for comfort, they give us comfort, but then they hold on too long and we want to go back down and play or do something else. And there's two parts to ideal parenting. One is letting your kid go out and explore as much as they want because they start to toddle away as soon as they can move. But when they get scared, they want to come back and get that comfort. So you want to be there to give them the comfort, but you also want to let them go. And this is the same in leadership. If we want to have really good employees or a really well-working organization, we want our people underneath us to develop as much as they can, but being there to catch them if they fall or help them when they, it's a little too hard. But then also really let them go again, not, oh, they failed that test, now no more. I'll never trust them again. That's not helpful. So in this adaptation, what you learn to do, because you don't internalize a feeling like things are going to work out, what you internalize is maybe they'll work out, maybe they won't. I don't know what's going to happen. And that leads to a preoccupation with our parents, you know, because we're anxious about what's going to happen. It's an anxious attachment where we're looking to our parents like, okay, if I cling to them, maybe I'll get what I need because eventually they're going to get it right. And it leads to a preoccupation where we don't feel okay on our own. And, you know, this doesn't work well for leadership, as you can imagine, because the issue is you're feeling needing reassurance from people. I think of a business leader I know who has this type of attachment, and you know, she wants all her employees to like her so much. But she's also a bit narcissistic, so she's wants them to want to come along and do her things. And she considers that a treat if they get to go shopping with her, for her, not for them. I don't know. You know, it's sort of entertaining for them, maybe, and probably annoying to some of them a lot. But you know what I mean? But she has the energy, she has the intelligence to do a lot. But to really create that bigger vision that everybody can buy into is hard if you're looking for a lot of reassurance, right? And, you know, it also, you know, has made her quite angry at her superiors in any business because they're not just trusting her to completely do it. And she wants them to just buy into the fact that she's great and amazing, and get reassure her of that a lot. And, you know, that really wears thin on people, right? People don't like that and they get annoyed and they back up more, which doesn't get you what you want. You know what I mean? So this is how it interferes. And then the idea of disorganized attachment is when there is no organized strategy to get your needs met. And whether that, you know, that was a concept really initially put out there for it, you know, parent-child relationships, but the idea is where there's fear without solution. You're afraid, but the person you would go to for comfort is scary. They're either scary because they're directly frightening you by their behavior, or they're scary because when you go to them for comfort, they fall apart and get scared. So that's not very comforting, right? When you want comfort and reassurance, you don't want the person who's going, oh, wait, you're panicking, I'll panic too. That doesn't help, right? And so then what you get is there is no organized strategy because it's hard to know what you're going to get. And as a child, that's really, really disorganizing. And it can lead to developing a more organized ability to dissociate, to disconnect from your body or from your circumstances. And, you know, is very disruptive in a leadership style because you're all over the map and you're not, you know, one minute you might be expressing something, but then something triggers you and you get into an altered state and people don't understand what's going on. You know, they're not able to read your mind and they don't know why you're all of a sudden acting really differently. So I think about somebody who was put in a position of leadership at their church actually over employee relations. And incident happened with the pastor of the church where there was some rule where he wanted to fire somebody that this other person felt protective of. And anyhow, it got very complicated. And it really triggered him because he came from a very abusive background into an altered state. And he went from being this very refined Southern gentleman, always polite, always mild-mannered, to being his father, who was a raging, you know, I mean, he walked differently. He walked all of a sudden like the Marlboro Man, you know, like, whoa, 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 you know, I got to assert, you know, this power over you and I've got to fight this. And, you know, vocabulary changed, you know, where there was a lot of swearing. And I mean, like, who is this person? You know, but it was a possession kind of state that got triggered by a man in authority over him, as his father had once been. And his father had been really abusive. And whether or not the pastor was being abusive and firing this person, it's hard to know. You know, it's probably complicated. But for him, it triggered that old feeling. And he assumed that old identity, which, you know, was leading to all kind of chaos, you know, and disruption within his church, but also within his personal life, because all of a sudden he was very different. His friends and colleagues were all very quite worried about him. And we were able to get him out of that dissociation. And that was really powerful because then he was back to being himself. And then he could deal with whatever, right? Well, from a different perspective, this wasn't life or death like it was for him as a kid. His father was really physically abusive and it was really terrifying at times. But that's not what was happening in his adult life. Whether or not this person got fired at the church or not, it just wasn't life or death. I'm not saying it wasn't, there still wasn't a conflict to resolve, right? Conflicts happen in all situations where there's power and, we're trying to get something done. But that's, different than reacting from that place that, oh my gosh, that's not going to help anybody.
This is incredibly grounding. What I'm understanding is attachment styles develop by our awareness and understanding that we have a need, how we express that need, and then how that need is met. And it starts at our most infant stage, right? It starts as babies to our parents or to our caregivers. How you are able to be aware of your needs, express that need, and how that need is met starts to develop either a healthy attachment style, an anxious attachment style, an avoidant attachment style, or a disorganized attachment style. And so, what I'm hearing is a little bit of color and context behind avoidant, anxious, and disorganized attachment styles. And what I would love is to slow down with each of those and really, I think, highlight how are we as adults now in our adult lives, in leadership roles, in individual contributor roles, and in our organizations, working in systems, working in teams, how can we slow down just kind of those three different attachment styles? And kind of learn what are some characteristics? How do we bring awareness to how we show up and have our head on a swivel to kind of learn more about our behaviors, our responses, so that we can start managing them in a way that benefits not only ourselves in leadership roles, but those who we are leading and those who we are collaborating with. So if we were going to start with avoidant attachment styles, and what are some of the characteristics and how they might emerge in our leadership styles? What would that look like?
Right. It might look like the fact that we take on a lot of work because that's a really safe and comfortable place for us, where we feel in control, where relationships might be a little more messy and that's harder. So we can time. I think a lot of people with that attachment style sort of do channel their energy into work, which is, can be positive in some ways. But because we have this feeling like it's not okay to have needs and we don't want to be in touch with those, we're going to see the people around us as much more needy, demanding, incompetent than maybe they really are.
Yes.
And if they need anything from us.
Yes. And I think one of the points that you initially pointed out with this is avoidant styles tend to hoard tasks because it feels safer to be able to do the task or the responsibility themselves. And you brilliantly pointed out that what happens when we hoard or we don't share responsibility is that there's a lack of growth and development for those around you. So if you were truly heading a division of a company, and you have more of that avoidant style, then there's lack of opportunity to grow strength underneath that leadership if those responsibilities are being held so tightly and so closely to the leadership. And then what happens is that that strength really doesn't begin to float to the higher level. And so individuals can probably that are being led by an avoidant attachment style individual may feel lack of purpose, may feel lack of, healthy challenge or stress in the system. They may start to fall into a place of boredom or disconnect, or there's just not enough energy in the system because there's not enough exposure to new challenges, new responsibilities, and really growth and development in their career path.
Right. They're not getting mentored to be more, take on more. They're getting, sort of like, I don't want to have to depend on you. So just do this thing, these more minor things that, and I have to do all the important stuff. And what that, people don't like that. What motivates people is feeling a sense of challenge, but also feeling like they're getting acknowledged for that challenge, you know, for the their and they're doing it more collaboratively. So these are the things that are motivating. We like to feel like, you know, we're doing something collaboratively, and we don't feel that with a avoidant attachment leader. What we feel like is we're just a cog in the wheel somewhere down here. We're not an important part of the organization. And there isn't much acknowledgement, because even when we do do something, maybe that's a new challenge or do it well, you know, this person doesn't think we need praise. They think, you know, you should be able to just know that you're doing it or what. There's not a lot of give, and there's not a lot of interaction, and there's not that feeling of collaboration. It's like, I need to do everything myself from the leadership. What does that lead to? People feel like they're not important. They don't feel like they're, it doesn't have that sense of self-motivation to do something that it does when it's collaborative. We feel much more motivated. Newer ideas come up. You know, I think it limits the what, you know, the ideas that come up, or the areas that a business might go into or develop into, you know, if the leadership is all centered in one person. You know, because what we know now is that, you know, a lot of minds working together works better. And see, this is what we get with a secure attachment, is we are very pro-social, and we are happy to give other people praise, and we know it's important, and we like it too, you know. And we there's that give and take, and we collaborate, and we want to support each other's growth. We don't feel threatened by it. Where somebody who's got avoidant attachment is going to be keep a tighter lid on things and not be so excited by people wanting to take over more. And if people advocate for themselves and want more, that's going to be seen as a threat and a challenge that is not welcome necessarily.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about what perhaps the experience of someone who's being led by an avoidant attachment style, but let's talk about the cost and the impact on the individual who's leading from a place of an avoidant attachment style. So, you know, I'm going to throw some ideas, but immediately what comes to mind to me is that an individual with an avoidant style would, be really in a position to experience great burnout. Because if you're actually holding all of this responsibility and holding the world on your shoulders because that feels safest, that is so much pressure and volume of work and weight that you're holding. And so perhaps you would be, you might lead, it may lead you to a quicker burnout level. I would imagine if you're operating in a place where you're almost near burnout, you're kind of in that fight or flight state that you become, you know, shorter, you know, with your responses and less patience, or even your awareness starts to probably go from a greater expansive awareness to a tighter awareness because you're so focused and so kind of rigid and hanging so tightly onto what is your responsibility. So those are some things that come up from my perspective.
Yeah.
Through the coaching world, what comes up for you?
Highly stressed. You're stressed because you can't depend on others. And you justify that idea by not setting people up for success, you know? And so you're feeling the stress and the burden, and like you have to work all the time. And like you said, which can lead to burnout, but it also just takes a huge toll on you physically and emotionally to be that stressed. And probably your personal relationships are suffering, my guess is, and that people are feeling pretty lonely who are close to you in your life. And your kids might not know your name, and your partner might have forgotten who you were about. You know, I mean, you know, there's that kind of thing often going on too, where you're not really relating that much. And you know, it's funny because avoidant attachment people act like they don't need anybody, but if somebody leaves, they actually are incredibly stressed. And that's probably true for employees as well as spouses, because it's the status quo that's comfortable for them. And they want you there even though they don't act like it.
Yes. And can you remind myself and listeners what happens when what happens to our brain when we're experiencing high levels of stress? Because at times we think high levels of stress is what's driving us to the next thing, but it actually has such an impact on how we are taking in information, retaining information, being able to make clear decisions. Can you share a little bit about what the impact of operating at that high level of stress can be to
Yeah.
brains?
Right. Doing it ongoing is not constructive, right? So some stress is important, and even high stress for short periods can actually heighten, our if we have a positive mindset about stress, can be like, oh, this is a new challenge, right? Or something like that. And I can, make this happen if we're feeling capable. But if we're feeling overwhelmed by stress and we're feeling like stress is a burden and it's constant, then we do get burnt out and we do shut down. And like you said, we're more reactive to little things that are going wrong because, we're in this already heightened arousal place of stress. We may be feeling some physical symptoms, maybe having starting to have panic attacks or having, that kind of thing go on where we're, really getting flooded. And especially when this person doesn't show up right when we think they should or doesn't follow up and, quite the way we thought they should. And, so our stress goes up and that can make us, like you said, very short, but also harsh with people below us. And that does not motivate them more. And we have a really good research showing reward works a lot better than punishment. And reward for successes of approximations of behavior works really well. So, the person doesn't have to be perfect the first time, but they did it a little better than last time and a little better. If we're encouraging that, we're going to get much better performance. When we're tearing somebody down, that rarely works, as a way to get people really motivated. Or even if it gets a short-term performance out of somebody, it makes them start to really resent you. It doesn't work for the long term. It doesn't build any loyalty, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So, with the avoidant attachment style, we have an understanding of what it is to be led, by an individual with this attachment style. We have an understanding of what is the personal experience, or what are some of the things that can start to surface if you are operating and existing with an avoidant attachment style. We have to have so much grace and empathy for ourselves because these attachment styles come from a place of what we believe survival and ultimate safety for ourselves to move through this world. But if you are someone who is listening to this and starting to be able to identify some characteristics or behaviors within yourself as an avoidant attachment style, what are some things? How can we meet ourselves? What are maybe some tools or ways that we can start to, okay, we have the awareness. Yes, I can see that I feel safer when I hold all of this responsibility. What are some ways that we can start as an avoidant attachment style, feel safe and to meet ourselves so that we can actually show up a little more productive for ourselves and for those that we are interacting with?
Right. I mean, I think first that part you said about being, not beating ourselves up about it, right? We didn't develop this for no reason, and we didn't develop it as a choice. What we did is we made the best adaptation we could to what was there, and that was as our nervous system was getting laid down, right? So it is, it is in our brain, it is in our bones, it is in us, but we need to be kind to ourselves about it, right? We came by that honestly. And so, we might even disapprove of a behavior that we engage in, like being too harsh on people. But, beating ourselves up about that doesn't help either. It really helps to have a what Dan Siegel, a friend and colleague of mine, calls a Cole attitude toward yourself. Curious, open, accepting, and loving, no matter what. This is part of what people might call self-compassion. It's about changing your relationship to yourself. It's not about letting yourself off easy or saying it's okay, you're good even when you're not being good. It's about having a kind attitude toward yourself and being really curious. Like, gosh, what is getting triggered for me that I'm acting like this? What's going on inside me? So we can get really curious about ourselves and with a kind attitude. And then, it's really looking at how can we develop more ability to tune in to what other people need, what we need maybe. It helps to do anything that really exercises our right brain. And partly in a lot of leadership positions, it's very logical, linear, we're doing a lot of left brain stuff, but we're not having that bigger picture of kind of creativity and valuing that part of us too. And that's really important. And so anything we can do to get our right hemisphere working more, which might be anything from watching movies without the sound and having to try to figure out what's going on just from the body language. Gets us tuned into body language, doing body scans and getting in touch with our own body. People can access these online very easily. It's all part of mindfulness-based stress reduction. A lot of times, cancer centers run groups, but other people in the community can join. I know a couple who did it as a date night, going to the mindfulness group in town, where they did do that body scan idea of paying attention to what's going on in your body. Because when we're, avoidant, we tend to want to live in our head. We don't want to be in touch with all these messy bodily needs. We want to stay up here safe. But the reality is we do have a body and it's really important to tune into it. And when you start to do that, you start to see other people more too, like in a more, inclusive way, so that's important. And, I suggest people journal and just pay attention to even just a slight want or need they might have and write that down. Maybe be willing to take some, small steps towards taking some positive risks with asking for what they want or need. And maybe doing some techniques to help themselves calm down when they get upset as they try to do that, because they're gonna feel feelings come up. And so we often suggest people develop sort of a toolkit of skills, whether that be, some deep breathing, or whether it's putting one hand over your chest and one hand over your heart and sort of sinking back into your body. It's very calming. There's different ways we can go about bringing some calm back down. Because if we start to challenge these things, we're going to feel anxious. Because we're messing with our basic feeling of safety. And even though it's not life-threatening in the now, you have to realize that these feelings come from when we were an infant who was helpless. And it felt like life and death, because it was. If the people in your life walk away from you when you're a newborn, you don't survive. I mean, it really is life and death to get these people to take care of me. It's very different than as an adult, you're not very likely not to survive, even if things don't go perfectly. And certainly not if your employee doesn't, or the person handling a project doesn't do it quite the way you would. That doesn't mean you're going to die. In fact, sometimes it might be better. And that's really, a challenge, but, it might. And so, realizing that we can take some chances like that.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing with avoidant attachment style, some of the things that you can slowly start integrating into your practice is one, recognizing perhaps what are your needs from a physical standpoint, and even emotional and even responsibility level, but just really understanding what your needs are and practicing taking some low risk chances on those needs, practicing asking for what those needs are. Because what I'm understanding is if you can start to begin and understand your own needs and feel courageous enough to build safety around asking for your own needs, you can begin to recognize needs in others. And so the idea is that awareness of self and then begin to start practicing with self so that you can be there for others as well. I absolutely love this idea of Dan Siegel's of curious, open, accepting, and loving. And that is probably something we can hold a lens of in so many different things through all of these attachment styles. But I love that it came up and came forward and avoid an attachment style. But that idea of being curious, open, accepting, and loving, and then starting to bring awareness forward of what your own individual needs are, how to safely and small steps start asking for those needs so that you can actually be able to have that awareness of others as well.
Right. And with the people who, you're leading, they will rise much more to the challenge if you do ask them for things that you need. And the more aware you are of what exactly it is you need from them, the more they can potentially provide it, right? If you're very vague in what you tell them, guess what? They don't get it and they're not going to do it exactly what you want it necessarily. if you can't really express that. And so getting better at expressing things you need is really important. And there's so many times people think they're deferring to other people's need. Like, oh, I said that because I thought it's what you wanted. Well, you know what? The other person might be doing that too, and nobody's getting what they want or what they need in terms of whatever the situation is, you know? And it's really important to try to pay a little bit more attention to those needs and wants.
What a great place to start for an avoidant attachment style. Let's shift a little bit into anxious attachment style. What are some characteristics, maybe, for this particular attachment style for for those that they're leading? What would be the experience for those they're leading for an anxious attachment style?
Yeah, there's a feeling of, too close oversight because there's this preoccupation with, is it going to be okay? Is it not going to be okay? So there's not this calm, which being calm as a leader is really important, right? For people to feel inspired by you. If you are anxious and wound up about things, there you're going to make, everybody underneath work feel more caught, anxious too. So I think the experience as somebody working for somebody like that is like, are they going to think it's right this time? Is it right that time? There becomes this anxiety about getting criticized if it's not right. There's this focus and there's a need for a lot of reassurance. And that comes across too, with having, maybe to be filled in on every little step or, instead of, oh, I've got this. It's going to be okay, which, yeah, that takes a leap of faith, right? As a leader, to, okay, you got this. It's going to be okay. But if you can do that, people often rise to the challenge. When you micromanage them, they don't. So I think there tends to be where the other person, the avoidant person, isn't giving up much to do. The more anxious person is probably over micromanaging. Are you doing it exactly right? Wait, let me see it, again. And what's the plan here? And that anxiety will come out, which doesn't build confidence in the people working for you or competence. So what you would really like is, somebody to be more calm and to give you control of a project and trust you, even if it's a little bit of a leap, So I think there tends to be more of that, where there's just, it's hard to, really let go all the way. So it's letting go, but it's like, I need you. But and for those directly working with that person, they might feel a lot of dependence being put on them, like I'd have to be here all the time. And even if I'm not doing anything, and that doesn't make people motivated either. It's about me standing here and that's not a good feeling exactly.
Yes. And then if we think about an avoidant attachment style for the individual, it's interesting. Again, what comes to mind is the same thing, is this level of burnout, but it's different than avoidant in the way that rather than holding everything, the lack of efficiency comes from it being almost like these porous boundaries, this like so much energy in receiving validation and checking in so much with others. And, are you standing right there? There's just seems like there's a lot of kind of wasted energy in needing that constant cycle of feedback and validation and connection and this constant scanning of awareness, right? Versus the avoidant that just suppresses the needs and maybe not as aware, where it sounds like the anxious attachment style is this constant head on a swivel. Where is everyone? Where am I? Is this good enough? Did you do this? And it just seems like there's just so
And the
much output of energy. Yeah.
there is, and the volume is turned up on their needs. So whereas the other, if avoidant has turned it down, this is I need it all the time. This has got to be happening all the time. And so it's very intense. And they can get yanked away by other things, Oh, but my partner called. I got to respond, oh, because I need that validation. Or my, it's I, so it's more chaotic, if you will. But it's because it's needing that reassurance and they're not feeling that internalized calm. like everything's going to work out. They think maybe it's going to work out, maybe it's not, maybe it's, because that's what they experienced. And so that doesn't lead to a calmness. And, when you get somebody who's got that anxious attachment with somebody who's got that avoidant, this person's needing reassurance, which makes this person feel like I got to pull back more, and this person's pulling back makes this person feel like, yes, I need to go after that more, right? So, there's the leadership style and that person's attachment, but there's also the people who work for you, their attachment. And they're, so when you get one of those things going where it's a bad fit, you can imagine an anxious person needs a lot of feedback from their boss and the boss is avoidant. That's, that boss is going to be like, wow, that's way too needy of a person. And, people get caught in these cycles and they stay in them. You would think they just, okay, they would leave, right? That's not working for us. But in relationships and in whether they're in business or in our personal lives, we get stuck in those because that's what we're adapted for. So the avoidant is adapted for shutting down, and the anxious person is adapted for somebody who is shutting down. And so it's not I, people get stuck in these things because, and they're very compelling. Because the anxious person is having all this emotion and this person's having none, and so it kind of, there's this draw to it, but it's not a healthy in personal relationships and it's not healthy in work relationships to stay stuck in those things that aren't working for you. But you'll see people keep an assistant that they, is driving them crazy, or stay in a job where the boss is driving them crazy. And how many times, and you're just going, wait a minute. Let's think about this.
I want to talk a little bit more about that later on in regards to what happens when you've got kind of the perfect storm with an avoidant, with an anxious, and not really being able to meet each other's needs and actually reacting to each other's lack of needs or strong needs.
Yeah.
But before we move that direction, I would really love to hear maybe two really clear kind of behaviors or responses in an anxious attachment style. Like if I was kind of scanning my own behaviors and responses, what might I notice in myself that would bring some awareness to the fact that I might be operating in an anxious attachment style?
Yeah, that well, I would look for that underlying feeling of anxiety in you too, that like, okay, my needs aren't going to get met. I need to express them a lot and loudly. And if you notice yourself doing that, making demands loudly, feeling, very dysregulated if, people aren't listening to your needs or reassuring you about how things are going. So, if you give over a project and you stay a little distant from it, you may feel very anxious. And, if you're trying to express changes you'd like to happen or needs, you feel like nobody's going to listen. Or maybe you feel like nobody is listening. You perceive it that way, even if they are responding, but just not at the volume that you're feeling it. So it's really looking at, how do I come across in those ways, and how do people see it, and it's looking at, do you have any sense of internalized calm around this? You might not. And it these are not things, I've been at conferences or places where people say, oh, so raise your hand if you have this type of attachment style. People are not very good at identifying this stuff so easily themselves. It really does take some self-reflection and really thinking about it, like, oh, and you might think back about your childhood some and think about, how is it with my parents? If it still feels very alive to you today. So when you're thinking about your parents, it's not about, oh, wait, how are they when I was young? It's, oh, but if they paid enough attention to me today, or do they pay more attention to my sister still, or my brother, or the whatever, you're just going, okay, wait a minute. This is not the, yes, your family's important, but it's not where you live, as an adult. Your original family, you're now an adult. You're also, even if it was, even if you still are around those people, you know what? They're not, you're not in the same position in relation to them. So even if you work, for instance, in a family business, which, is one way of really keeping this stuff alive, And I'm not saying it can't work. It can sometimes, but with a lot of awareness. And, because we're going to trigger each other because it's the same even person with same tone of voice or same patterns and styles. But, you can look at, what are those feelings that come up for me? And am I still preoccupied with getting my parents' love? Which everybody wants their parents' approval and love. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but when it's a preoccupation and it needs to be re-expressed all the time to be okay, that's a different thing. And are we looking for approval from our employees? That's, and again, not with a harsh attitude toward ourselves, like we shouldn't be like that or what's wrong with us, but with a curious attitude of, wow, this is information that might help me develop and be a more effective leader, not, oh, this is, I'm so bad. I've got to change all these things, because that just doesn't work. Beating ourselves doesn't work up, doesn't work any better than other people doing it.
Absolutely. So if we were going to, we're going to just again continue this lens through each attachment style. So first meeting ourselves with curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love. And then what would be in an anxious attachment style, what are maybe one or two kind of tools that you can bring forth that will slowly, or practices that you want to do that can slowly start to bring safety into your world?
Right. Well, mindfulness is helpful for any of the attachment styles. And the reason why is because it helps us slow down and not get so attached to our thoughts and feelings. So our thoughts and feelings are real, right? But they're sometimes reactions from the past. And so it's really important not to get too wedded to them. Like, I feel upset, so that means things are upsetting. No, it might be I feel upset because I'm trying something new and this is scary. It's how we interpret it. And that upset or anxiety could be excitement or it could be fear. You go on a roller coaster, some people experience it as thrilling and some people experience it as terrifying, and that's true about all things in life, right? Risks we take in our work lives too, right? So, it's starting to, get and getting strategies to calm ourselves down, not looking for everybody else to do it all the time, but how can we get our own inner calm? What are things we can do? So when things are really tense, can we go take a walk? Because you know what? Walking is rhythmical and predictable and will calm you down. You pick up one foot, you put down the other. If we can't leave the premises, can we pay attention to our breathing? You breathe in, you're going to breathe out. When you breathe out, you're going to breathe in. But doing some physical activity during, our lunch hour might be a really good idea if we have this attachment style because it helps you calm down, right? If you do something aerobic particularly. That's just true. So there's different parts of that and putting more logic to things. So when we're talking, making sure that things are linear and logical, not just in our own minds, but to other people too. So maybe checking in about whether this makes sense. And here's my thought process on this timeline. Is that how you saw it? But not how you saw it so you can reassure me that I'm right, but no, really, help me understand that it might, I might have the volume up. And so it's doing things that help you develop more inner calm and tools for calming yourself down so that you can then reconnect with others in a more healthy way. And especially if you're in a leadership position, it's really important because if there's a feeling like there's not calm at the top, that permeates an organization or a group or whatever we're working in. It doesn't has a big impact on others, but if there's calm at the top, even if it's not the most founded calm, people do feel calmer.
Let's pivot towards disorganized attachment style and learn a little bit more about what is the felt experience of those who are being led by someone with a disorganized attachment style. We can start there.
Yeah, things feel very unpredictable, right? Because the person can have this fractured sense of self that so we're getting different people at different points, right? So if your boss seems to be very different people, I know an organization with a sales manager where he can see all com he likes everything in its little boxes very much, which sort of stifles a lot of the creativity of the business, but there's also some good stuff to having structure, right? So but this is a person who can be easily set off into a rage and raging at, people who work under you is not a good idea. Raging at people who are your peers in a situation or people that you work for is not healthy and doesn't go well, So, not being able to modulate mood, and that alternating from being very rigid to whoa, now you're, a 10 out of 10 all of a sudden and nothing happened, what happened, it that's, so mood regulation may be an issue, perception of things maybe, and in the dissociation there's this disconnect. So, we all get triggered at moments. It doesn't matter what type of attachment we have, even if it was secure, and it was mostly good. We can get triggered at moments where we lose perspective, right? Something brings up a feeling that dysregulates us, we get dysregulated. But when we have the healthier our attachment is, the more we can go, oh, okay, I got dysregulated, do something to regulate ourselves, and then repair. When we have a disorganized attachment, we're not going to be able to do that. We're going to get triggered by many, many more things. We're going to get stuck there longer. I'm going to have a really hard time repairing because we don't even know what we did, all of it. This is the boss who says, I never said that. What do you mean? When they just raged at you and said that. And arguing with them about the fact that they said it is not helpful, by the way, because they don't know they did. And for them, their experience is really like, what the heck are you talking about? But they did it in a disconnected state. So, this is going to be really problematic for people working under somebody, right? Because, sometimes you can go to this person for help or get, direction when, and sometimes they're going to rage at you and that, and or sometimes they're going to just be not present or not respond because they're kind of zoned out, and you're kind of like, okay, this is really confusing. So I would say the biggest thing it leads to is confusion. And the more you're invested in the job or the more dependent you are on that person, the more dysregulating it's going to be, right? Because if you're dependent in any way on somebody who's that fragmented, it's confusing and really hard. And so relationships, whether they're at work or in your personal life, are not going to go very well when you have some elements of disorganization. And what I would say is that people with unresolved trauma have fragments of this to degrees, and that we all have some unresolved trauma. Now, that doesn't mean I think everybody was abused, physically abused or majorly neglected, but we all have experiences from our early life where that changed how we saw ourselves, other people, or the world. And those experiences aren't often resolved. I was talking with somebody about this the other day, and they had to move a lot of times as a kid because their dad was in the military, right? So different countries, different environments, different schools. And, especially as you get to be a child that's, older than five, you're attached to your peers and you get comfortable in an environment. And then, boom, it changes completely. And you're always the new person in a situation. They said actually the best experience is when they were on a base in a foreign country because all the kids in the base school were, had been through this a million times. You weren't different. You were like the other kids. But that kind of feeling is disorienting, right? And so that's a trauma. Now, it doesn't mean you had a bad parent. It means you had a parent that was doing their job, right? Which was to move to these different places. But in that's disruptive for children, right? And, especially if your parents are not particularly attuned to the fact that, yeah, this is going to be hard. And how are we going to make it as easy as possible? And, is this a good new environment for my, and it's not that parents always have so many choices either, right? So anyhow, there's limits to what parents can do about that, but you can pay attention to the fact of how disorienting that is. And it was, so it's often unresolved trauma, not because we were treated so badly, but because things happened that we didn't have any power. When you decide to move to a new city to take a job, right, or to advance your career, you're making a choice. And that's power, and if you don't like it, you can make a different choice. As a kid, you don't get to say, you know what, I really don't like it here. I think I'd like to go back to that other place. Your parents are like, yeah, good luck.
Absolutely. What are some what is the kind of felt experience for the individual with a disoriented attachment style? Like, what are some characteristics that emerge, and what is the felt experience and kind of cost on the individual?
They don't have an integrated sense of self, so it's a huge cost on an individual. They probably have more dissociation than most. They're getting lost in triggered experiences that are shifting them into different aspects of their fractured self. And so they're having a very disruptive experience. Their interpersonal relationships are usually troubled. Their work relationships are often troubled. If you have an employee who's like this, they may be great when things are stable, but something sets them off and they're a whole different, you lose their functionality or their ability to function well. So there are remnants of this in their adult life. And again, you can have some elements of disorganization, but you also have, you can be, avoidant with some disorganization. You can be anxious with some disorganization. You can even be secure with some disorganization. And the more a person with that resolves their trauma, so they, often really need some kind of trauma treatment. Not all therapy is trauma informed. So they need a therapy that is trauma informed, that understands that there may be some disorganization, that understands something about dissociation, and so it's not like a behavioral kind of quick fix kind of thing is going to work for that. It's more about really understanding what happened to you and getting some ability to integrate these just, fragmented parts of yourself and build an identity. So that's probably going to take a little longer. It's going to take a therapy that has some trauma informed elements of it. And, there are a bunch of really now really good trauma treatments, including, yoga for traumatized people, so it's not that there's one way to do this, but, partly what yoga does is it requires you to be mindful because you can't hold a pose if you're not paying attention, right? If you're getting lost in thought, you're not going to hold a pose. It doesn't work that way, in yoga. So, there's one of the things that's been found really helpful for people with trauma, so is mindfulness. Now, that doesn't mean that mindfulness is going to be easy for somebody like that. It's going to actually maybe bring up some really upsetting feelings. So it's doing it in the context of having support, and getting the treatment that you need.
So what I'm hearing for a disorganized attachment style, the greatest thing we can do for ourselves is just have the awareness that perhaps this is the attachment style. This is kind of the way that we are showing up, we're operating, and then seek some outside support and resources that really can allow you to resolve perhaps the trauma that's driving those fractures and disassociation and the experience, which again just sounds like so, it's kind of sounds like whiplash, not only for the individual, but for those who are experiencing as well. And again, I think this lens of bringing that curiosity, openness, and acceptance and love to at least acknowledge where you're at and invite in that support. Like you said, it's not going to be easy, but the benefit of, reclaiming yourself in getting that type of support and resources is probably invaluable to that individual and their relationships and their work life.
Right. Everything in life will go better if you start to resolve some of that unresolved trauma. And, people want a quick fix and a way around, but we kind of have to walk through it. And I think that's true for all of us, But again, with a kind attitude, this didn't happen for no reason. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It means you had a rough beginning, And again, that doesn't mean that somebody was a monster. It means that somebody, probably had unresolved trauma themselves. So, unresolved trauma haunts us in a way that resolved trauma doesn't.
Yes.
All experiences in our life, even the really difficult ones, inform who we are, but they don't define who we are. And that's really important to remember, that you don't have to get into a fixed identity. Oh, I'm a trauma survivor. Well, yes, you are a trauma survivor and have all the compassion for yourself in the world, but that's different than that's my identity. That's a part of who I am. And it informs who I am, but doesn't have to define who I am. When we can narrate our trauma and get more awareness of it, it has less hold over us. Then we're deciding how to think about it and when we think about it, instead of it just visiting us when we're at least expecting it and throwing everything, up in the air and disrupting our lives.
I think what's really incredible that I'd like to highlight that we talked about trauma in our last episode, and here we're talking about attachment styles. And one of the things that you shared in our last episode that is visiting us again is that we as adults have the power, and we are not, there's not that power imbalance anymore, and that we have choice as adults, and that we can start to cultivate and create safety in a healthy way, that we can start repairing and resolving some of the trauma from our past or that is still resides within us. And I think to me, that is such a place of hopefulness and a place of possibility to reclaim power and start moving in a way that's going to give such a great return to an individual. And so I think just highlighting that for our listeners that we have the power now, and we have the choice to kind of move forward in the way that we see is best for us to heal some of this trauma and or start to unravel some of these attachment styles that may be operating at a high intensity or maybe not a high intensity, maybe just some things that get, kicked up from time to time. Can you share with us a little bit about a secure attachment style?
With a secure attachment style, you do have that feeling like it's okay to be in touch with your needs. It's okay to express them. And, things are likely to work out. Not because everything's going to be perfectly smooth, but because you have the ability to repair when it isn't. And with that, you can be much more, you're going to have much more pro-social behavior. You're going to have more sense of other people and their feelings and the things that they want or need. And you're going to be able to be more collaborative with others and more creative in developing things and more balanced. You're still going to have your individual strengths, right? So maybe you are a more logical, linear person in how you think, or maybe you are a more creative person, or but you have all those aspects because we all have all these things. We're not just one thing. We're, a myriad of things, right? And, when you have secure attachment, you're more likely to be more yourself, not have these overlays on your personality that are not adaptive. And you're more likely to be open and supportive of others. So other people are gonna like you better and they're gonna be more motivated by you. So that's why it's worth developing that inner security. And we can all work towards inner security. So yes, these things happen when we're a child. And yes, our brain may have developed certain ways that it tends to operate. But you know what? That doesn't mean it has to stay that way. We can get back to what Dan Siegel calls the plane of possibilities. We develop certain fixed things that are outside those planes of possibilities, peaks and valleys, but we can drop back in to our experience and develop more that open plane of possibilities of who we can be and how we can do things. And that's really, major.
What is the impact or influence of someone who has a secure attachment style to those perhaps who are operating in, anxious or avoidant and or disorganized? What is the impact or influence of those who are operating from a secure attachment style?
Right. It can actually help to heal those people, actually, if you stay in relationship with them. A secure person might say, hey, I'm out of here. I can't take this. So, that's not great. But, because, that too much emotion or no emotion is going to be really rough for them because they're like, okay, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense. But with secure attachment, and if you stick in a relationship with somebody with secure attachment, you actually start to develop more inner security. And this is true whether it's your boss or whether it's your spouse or whoever you might be relating to, a good friend. It's important to try to find those people in our lives and to stay in good relationships with them and really sort of try to internalize some of their sense of calm. And you will provide that for people because you'll tend to be a stable influence. Not that you're completely predictable and everything's the same every time, but you're going to have a warm response and you're going to be open to things. And you're not going to be quick to shut down with them or to, seek reassurance from them. And so it can really be stabilizing for somebody who doesn't have as much security to relate to somebody with a more secure attachment. And so that's really important, And so just being around that person is helpful. Cultivating friends who are that way, wonderful. Relationships with people who are like that, finding a boss like that is really amazing. Doesn't happen all the time, right? But, or flying employees like that. If you are in a position of leadership, finding people to fill positions that have more of that balance and inner security is wonderful when we can find it. But also realizing nobody's perfect and they're going to have some rough edges, probably, whether they're in a position of power in relation to us or whether we're in a position of power in relation to them, it doesn't matter. More on an equal footing, expect some rough patches because there are no perfect people. And, that sometimes their behavior is challenging to us because it is unfamiliar, even though it's more secure.
Yes. What is one thing that you would like to share with our listeners who have either just today been exposed to what attachment styles are or have now received a little bit further in-depth information on how each attachment style operates? What's maybe one thing you would want to share with our listeners who are just coming to this information and are taking some insights with them? What's one thing you'd like to share with them as they leave this episode?
I think the biggest thing is that this is something that is, you're still adapting and you can adapt, So you had a style that you developed that you was best thing you could do at the time. But when you become aware of it, you get to be the active author of your future. So, it's when we're unaware of it, these things are influencing us and driving our life in all kinds of ways that, we're not really fully aware of. And the more that we become aware of it, the more we can have power over it. And then you can decide who you want to be going forward. You can make changes, in how you interact with others. You can take different risks. And yeah, this stuff is a bit scary and it can be feel a little overwhelming, but you can deal with it because you know what? You're an adult now and you can handle it. And that's different than when you were a kid, where you really didn't have choices and you didn't have power. And now you can take a lot of authority over your life and decide who you want to be, how you want to show up for yourself and others, and start to make those changes. And that it's a process, and we can all develop more inner security. And it's a process that's ongoing. It's not like our brain is wired one way, and so now we're stuck here. There is where we can get back to that plane of possibilities and really make choices going forward and have a much more fulfilling, much more enlivened, much more in our current experience life, which has its own rewards. We have better relationships with others, things go better in your career, everything starts to blossom when you make these shifts. And so it's really worth it. But I have a lot of compassion for people. It's not easy.
Yes. Well, I appreciate again the insight, experience, wisdom, knowledge that you share around how we can become healthier individuals ourselves and how we can become healthy leaders within the world. I'm looking forward to what our next episode may hold for our leaders, but I so greatly appreciate today and really getting a deeper understanding and discovering a little bit more about attachment styles. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much, Kim.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend, follow Mindful Warrior Radio, and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior. And check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.